This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Do I Dare to Eat a Peach edition. It's Wednesday, November 29th, 2017. On today's show, Call Me By Your Name is the new film by director Luca Guadagnino. It is ravishing critics and audiences alike. We cannot wait to discuss ourselves. And then 30 years ago, She's Gotta Have It was a breakthrough film for Spike Lee. It broke him and it broke through black cinema in America. It's now on Netflix as a reboot. We're joined by Slate's own Aisha Harris to discuss. And finally, an urban legend about a mysterious, unmarked 1980s video game is explored in the podcast series The Polybius Conspiracy. But is it too something of a lark? We will discuss with Slate's own Jacob Brogan. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Lark is generous. Hello.
Lark, really? Oh, my. All right. Well, there's a
commentary begins now.
Yes. Can we get through the intros before you start editorializing?
Fine.
Julia? And of course, Slate's film critic is Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey there, Stephen.
All right. Why don't we just dig right in? Call Me By Your Name is directed by Luca Guadagnino and written by James Ivory, he of Merchant Ivory fame. It's adapted from the 2007 novel by Andre Aciman. Here a disclosure, I know Andre Aciman and a producer of the film, Peter Spears, so you may take what I say with a grain of salt. I will also say I saw the film seated next to my gay 14-year-old daughter. We were both transfixed, and I regard the film as a masterpiece. But moving on. It tells the story of a summer romance between a precocious 17-year-old boy and his father's live-in research assistant after the two are thrown together in the host family's Italian villa. Elio Perlman, as played by Timothée Chalamet, is a singular creation, a 17-year-old prodigy who is believable, a rare thing, I would say. He's omnisciently read, gifted musically, at home in any one of several languages. He is beautiful, sly, perhaps a little cruel. And he first regards Oliver, played by Armie Hammer, jealously as a usurper and perhaps even a fraud, and tests him and often bests him. But his contempt for the American boob hides something else, and the film turns into a love story every bit as strange, tender, layered, and complex as Elio himself. Let's listen to a clip.
So World War II, huh?
Oh, no, this is World War I. Huh. You have to be at least 80 years old to have known any of them.
Huh. I never even heard of the Battle of Piave.
Battle of Piave is one of the most lethal battles in World War I. 170,000 people die.
Is there anything you don't know?
I know nothing, Oliver.
Well, you seem to know more than anybody else around here.
Well, if you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what things.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I thought you should know.
Dana, that scene, it is almost, it's beautiful in itself, but it's hard a little bit to understand in isolation. It comes after many, many minutes of building tension amidst a wonderfully played ambiguity between these two leads. And we're just in that scene that you just heard on the cusp of the relationship between these two young men happening. What a remarkable scene from really a remarkable film.
Yeah, it's funny that that ended up being our clip because that is something of, it doesn't sound like it, heard out of context, but it's something of an emotional spoiler because that really is the moment of confession between Elio and Oliver, the two leads, the romantic leads of this movie. And also that clip, hearing it in audio, is an illustration of why cinema is cinema and it has to be cinema, because the way that shot is staged, the two of them are looking at this World War I monument that they're talking about, and the camera follows them in such a way that the monument comes between them, and you can see the back of one of their faces and nothing at all of the other, but you know that the two of them can see each other. So the way the whole thing is blocked in this long take is just, that is such a triumphant shot for me. It almost doesn't need conversation for you to know that that's the confession that's happening between them. It's yes. Beautiful. Well, I mean, as you can tell from my raving about that shot, I also love this movie. I'm a little bit afraid this segment will just be a swoon fest. Maybe Julia can throw some vinegar on us or something. But this is just the kind of movie, I say this in my review, that you kind of move into and just live in for 2 hours, because it takes place in such beautiful surroundings and with such beautiful people. And so it is a little bit hard to be objective about this movie, especially seeing it at the beginning of a bleak winter. It just feels so much like summertime. It's just this beautiful summer romance. I don't know. Julia, tell us, do say something negative.
I'm not. I won't. I shan't. You can't make me. No, I really loved this movie. It's sumptuous. You sort of move into it. One thing I was curious to talk to you guys about is the portrayal of the gay romance in it, which it's clear at moments that they exist in a world where gay love and gay romance are not proclaimed on the piazzas of Northern Italy, particularly. And yet their attraction and love is largely met with support from the people around them. It's a different environment than something like Brokeback Mountain. And I almost began to wonder by the end of the film whether that the sort of fantasy of the place, this villa, this beautiful old villa with clanging shutters and gorgeous peach trees, was supposed to be slightly surreal in that way. I'm struggling to articulate myself, but I'm curious.
I thought it was made pretty clear that they had to keep it on the DL. I mean, even that scene mm-hmm. that we heard the clip from, the reason that they're mumbling across this statue in a piazza is because they can't just stroll hand in hand talking about it.
Yeah, I agree with Dana on this. I mean, this is the way I looked at it, is that this was very purposely not a movie about intolerance, and it didn't want to set off the gay romance against, you know, the gay experience. And I think that was a choice, that in a way it was going to be slightly fantastical and dreamy, you know, as Julia says, kind of pointed up by the, you know, sort of overwhelming beauty of the Italian villa and countryside, as a way of just making it about the experience of principally this boy in a way. And I thought the movie to contrast it to was less Brokeback Mountain and maybe more Moonlight. I mean, in some superficial way, this film is going to be this year's Moonlight. It's a gay romance, that an indie film about a gay romance that is probably going to blow up fairly big, because it's beautifully done. But in Moonlight's really a story of the ultimate intolerance towards gay men, a community that can't possibly sacrifice notions of masculinity to same-sex attract to the reality of same-sex attraction. And the struggle in that movie is about that young man making himself into a hardened and kind of hyper-masculine person and burying his homosexuality within it. And in some ways, this movie is the opposite of that. It offers a kind of beautiful contrast to Moonlight, because, you know, with intolerance tabled, it really becomes about the erotic life of Elio and the inner life of Elio. And at that age, those two things are sort of the same. Your erotic life is your inner life when you're 17, and everything is a sexual projection, or enters your consciousness in a highly sexualized way. And setting aside, in that respect, even the fact that this is a, you know, obviously a same-sex, you know, romance, I think it caught that beautifully, that tenderness and that moment of being on the verge of being a sexual adult, but not yet one, and the fluidity of it too. It's the ways in which He switches so fluidly between languages. He speaks Italian. He speaks French. He speaks English to his parents and his parents' friends. But also the fluidity of the sexuality. I mean, he's moving back and forth between homoerotic and heteroerotic attraction. And I thought all of that was just handled with the kind of lyrical perfection. And the funny thing was, I will say one other thing, which is that 5 minutes into the movie, I was shocked to discover I thought I wasn't going to like it, because a peeve of mine are movies that appear high cultured in a somewhat superficial way because they drop a ton of names. There are hyper learned people in them about, you know, about whom we're supposed to feel a combination of envy and kind of intimidation or something. And not only moves past that, it uses that so beautifully and so believably. I mean, in part because the people who created this movie speak that language themselves quite naturally. But the movie is about a young know-it-all from a family of pleasant know-it-alls who's discovering what he doesn't know, right? Which is kind of the essence of that scene with Hammer. And I think they've just made a remarkable movie. I mean, again, I know people behind the making of the movie, so our listeners are free to discount what I say. But for days after I saw it, I was in a trance, and I kept thinking, you know, I can't not apply the M word to it. I really think this movie is a masterpiece. All right, before we move on to one at least baby elephant in the room, which is the issue of consent, which has become topical, and I think we have to address it vis-a-vis this film, I want to say two quick things without spoiling anything, I hope. First of all, it is a huge part and a very important part of this movie and the emotional power of this movie, for the bulk of the movie, unanswered question of what his parents know and what precisely they would approve of. I think the movie's structured around the viewer not really knowing and Elio not really knowing whether or not he will be in trouble, A, for sleeping with the research assistant, and B, for having a gay romance. And then the second thing is, and Dana, I think you'll back me up on this, without giving anything away, that has to be one of the most moving final shots of really any film I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is one of those movies where the ending is what haunts you. And when you said it stayed with you for days afterwards, it was actually the very last shot that I thought about for days afterwards, which is a testament both to Guadagnino's choice to make that shot, which we won't spoil, and the acting of Timothée Chalamet, who in a sea of great performances, I think, steals the movie. I mean, he's really, really incredible.
Yeah, it is a question whether we Earthlings will be able to grab his ankle and keep him in terrestrial orbit before he flies off to some other planet where people are even cooler and more interesting and more talented than the best movie stars, because he's going off into some new, I mean, his performance in this film is just astonishing.
But did the consent question bother you guys, especially in the current? I mean, I had some people sort of attack me on Twitter for my very positive review of this movie, saying, how can you stand up for this movie when it's about a teenager being seduced? And one of the points that I made to them, and I think I make in the review as well, is that in the country where it's taking place, he actually is of the age of consent. It's 14 in Italy.
Mm. I mean, this movie, this is what I keep trying to get at inarticulately. This movie is so incredibly careful to frame this as extremely consensual and initiated by the 17-year-old and
And slowly unfolding, right, with lots and lots of stops and starts and hesitation on both parts.
Yeah, and it almost to a fault, the movie seems aware of the potential concern there and extremely conscious, like almost seeing the seams, noticeably conscious of making sure that Armie Hammer is constantly checking whether everything's okay and really resists, and the Elio character really has to try to initiate things 8 or 10 times before anything really happens and Oliver succumbs. And I actually don't think it's a mystery at all what the parents think of it. It may be a mystery a little bit to Elio, but it's extremely clear to the viewer from about 45 minutes through the film that the parents have a sense that Elio may be attracted to Oliver and that they're fine with it. Like, I did not think there was any mystery there at all.
Dana, do you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I was sort of waiting for the moment, just because it tends to happen in teen sex movies, that they got discovered by someone who disapproved. And I sort of like that the movie didn't go there and didn't go down that road. There's also a suggestion, I think, in a couple of scenes that the father, wonderfully played by Michael Stuhlbarg, has a homoerotic side as well, that he's repressed. Yeah. and that in some ways, although he seems to love his wife, that in some ways he also lusts after Armie Hammer, as who wouldn't?
We finally produced the controversy in this segment. Julia thinks the parents know. I think they don't.
I think that's what's so powerful about it, is that figuring out what love and sex are is thrilling and scary, separate from the question of whether your sexuality is accepted by the society that you're a part of. And this movie hinges on both of those uncertainties, the sort of uncertainty of what being a grown-up sexual being is, and then his uncertainty about his sexuality, I think, even in the context of an incredibly accepting and unusual and progressive family. And that makes it unusual and really powerful, I think.
And I think that that last shot that we're talking about is something that anyone who's loved and suffered for love will be weeping at, whether or not, you know, you've lived this kind of potentially taboo-breaking romance.
Okay. Call Me By Your Name is in staggered release. It'll come to you eventually. You should find it as soon as you can. We are three thumbs up to the sky, if I read the panel correctly. I thought it was a wonderful movie. Please go see it. Call Me By Your Name. Okay.
I'm one ancient statuary thumb slowly ascending from a northern Italian lake, actually.
That's how I've always thought of you, Julia.
Well, I'm a thumb embedded in a peach.
Oh, man. We all know where my thumb's been for years now. All right, moving on. All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we take care of some business. Julia, I'm sure we have some of that.
We do indeed. I want to tell our listeners about a new Slate show. It's If Then, a podcast about technology, society, and power. And it is so good, you guys. Each week, Slate's April Glazer and Will Oremus take you on a lively tour of the tech news that actually matters, from fake news in your Facebook feed to the algorithms that want your job to the Uber drivers who want benefits. With news-making interviews of key tech industry figures, fascinating academics, and top tech journalists, they explore how the technology that's shaping our world works and the ideas, ideologies, incentives, and biases that underlie it. My favorite thing about it is that Will and April are two incredibly smart and vivacious analysts of this industry. They both know a ton, and they often don't agree, so you get their fascinating perspectives, and you always learn more about every topic as they debate subjects back and forth. They do a really great job with these joint interviews, which is actually kind of a tricky format to pull off, but they've had really provocative and illuminating conversations with their guests. So please check out If Then wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we are going to be doing our yearly call-in show soon. If you have questions you want to ask us, leave a message at 929-266-4914. Again, that's 929-266-4914. You can ask Dana what three languages would be spoken at her fantasy North Italian villa. You can ask Steve exactly which North Italian Alps he'd like to frolic in.
I'm a French Alp guy. Thank you.
Not after this movie. I guess I was never a French Alp guy. Anyway, ask us questions, inspired or not inspired by Call Me By Your Name, and we will strive to answer them in a spirit of jollity and year-end cheer. Again, 929-266-4914. In Slate Plus today, we are joined by the effervescent June Thomas to talk about the engagement of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program, and it's a great way to support Slate and the journalism that we do. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gabfest and your other favorite Slate shows. And, of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, back to it.
All right, well, here's what I associate with the original She's Gotta Have It. The first is that it was being black and white. It was short. It was under 90 minutes. It was very sweet. It was very funny. It was a revelation. It showed black life as depicted by a black writer and director without white characters, much less a white savior figure. The question, I think, is that She's Gotta Have It reboot now on Netflix any one of those things. To discuss that, we have with us Aisha Harris, a Slate contributor. Hey, Aisha, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
Before we go any further, why don't we listen to a clip from this reboot, and then we'll dig in and discuss.
You're a sex addict, aren't you?
Wow. You are on some other light-skinned, green-eyed, blonde-haired, pretty boy bullshit today.
Methinks you are a sex addict.
Okay, so if I'm a sex addict, what does that make you?
I'm Greer Childs. I'm a grown-ass man.
And I'm a grown-ass woman. I can't enjoy sex. If I'm such an addict, why don't you leave me the hell alone?
Well, now you're getting defensive.
No, I'm not getting defensive. If I'm an addict, then I should quit cold turkey, right? You are numero uno on my list.
Shower.
Fuck you very much.
All right, well, of course, the voice we're hearing there is the character Nola Darling, who is featured in the original film, who refuses to choose between multiple suitors. She's an artist and a free spirit in Fort Greene. Aisha, I'm very curious to know what the original movie meant to you, and what do you think of the new version of it?
Well, I had not seen the original probably about a decade, maybe more, not since maybe late high school, college. So I didn't really remember it, although I've gone back to it a few times, and I recalled the very uncomfortable rape scene that Spike has since atoned for, both in public, and I think this whole show is sort of an atonement for that uncomfortable rape scene that happens towards the end between Nola Darling and Jamie Overstreet, one of her lovers. And Jamie is like the more straight-laced, very conventional, I want a wife and kids sort of man. So for my own experiment, I decided to rewatch the original right before diving into the new version. And I really, really disliked it.
Huh, how come?
The original version. Mm. I think just because of the politics, like the politics felt so icky, and I don't think it holds up. I don't think the politics hold up well. I feel like for the context of the time that it was made, I can totally understand why it was considered fresh and so different. And as you mentioned, Steve, at the top, like the fact that there are no white characters, this isn't about a movie about race. It's about black people, but like white people are not lording over it in that way. But just watching it again, I was like, first of all, the acting is terrible.
It's true.
It's truly terrible.
Tracy Camilla Johns, God bless her. She just is not comfortable on screen.
And you know what? I don't hold all these things against him per se, because this is his first feature film. And for a first feature film, I think it's really strong. But when you hold it up against his later work and just the politics now that exists, and even then I feel like the politics were already kind of screwy. And
the movie itself kind of believes that she's a freak, right? As all the guys keep calling her. There's a kind of both a fetishization and a contempt for her sex drive.
Yeah, but then at the end, the way it ends, it does sort of reassert her. Like she says, like, my body, my mind. I was gonna try monogamy, I've decided against it. And so in a way, I think at the end, Spike Lee thinks that he's empowering. He's written a very empowering female character, but he hasn't, because it's really more about what these men think about Nola Darling than like what she's figuring out about herself, which is why I really liked, and maybe this is partially because I had just watched the original, but it's why I really liked the new version, because I feel like, we do get a sense of who Nola Darling is, and she's, you know, I think it's a product of the time. It's 2017. Like, you can't write a character like Nola Darling like he wrote before now. And we see her actually working. Like, it's about her career. Like, we learn a little bit in the movie that she's like an artist, but that's it. Like, I think we see her painting maybe once or doing something once, but like, it's really just about her romantic entanglements, whereas this is about her wrestling with her romantic entanglements and how they are interfering with her career. And I just really appreciated that. And the acting is way better.
We should shout out DeWanda Wise, who plays Nola Darling, who to me was the only thing that made the series at all work. As we'll get to, I did not like it near as much as you, but I do think she's great in the main role.
Yeah, I think I might fall somewhere between the two of you, and I'm curious to hear what everybody else thought, but I... You know, for all that we lament the resuscitation of old IP on this show? And why does everything have to be a remake or a reboot or a revisitation or turning a game into a movie? Like, you know, why can't anybody just like write a story and tell a story? This does strike me as one of the better reasons, you know, a really fascinating expert, master, creator returning to subject matter they attempted earlier in their career with, you know, less experience and fewer resources and, you know, fewer decades of political understanding under their belt, and seeing what happens when they tackle it again with more dexterity. That's interesting, that kind of process of revisiting an old work. I really enjoyed that and have enjoyed reading the interviews with Spike Lee, where he kind of talks about the things he loves about the original and the things he got wrong and what he's doing here. The one thing that I was thinking about a bunch this week, in part because of Call Me By Your Name, is sort of like, what can movies do and what do TV shows do well? And Call Me By Your Name does strike me as this one, a thing that needs to be a movie. It makes sense for it to be a movie. It's about this episode. It's about this slow build. It's about kind of tension ratcheting. The sort of mannered pieces of the style here, where people are kind of talking direct to camera, and there's moments where text comes on screen, where shots of albums come on screen, for me did not work as well in the context of a TV show. I think I might grow accustomed to them over time and like them, but it felt a little fussy to me in a medium where I'm kind of more used to just directly getting to know the characters and follow them along. That was an initial response. I'm not sure it's one that I would even mark as a critique, because I think it might just be me getting used to a slightly different way of doing things. But I felt unfamiliar to see that kind of stylistic flourish, which is so fun and makes you feel like you're in capable, confident hands sitting in a darkened theater. In my living room, I was kind of like, ugh, get over yourself and just tell a story.
I completely agree. I mean, it's rare, and especially given that Spike Lee is the directorial hand behind this, if not the writer of most of the episodes. In fact, most of the episodes are written by women, which is interesting given that he is kind of trying to atone for the original She's Gotta Have It. But I found specifically the direction cloying, cute, overly fussy is a good word for it, that every minute there had to be a hashtag appearing or somebody's text floating by on the screen, or like you say, a shot of the album cover of whatever music was playing in the last scene. And it just started to really interrupt the flow of the story to me.
Yeah, it's very invasive. I mean, and it points up the difference between an auteur and a showrunner, right? Like, so, you know, the auteur is the film director who, in the space of a very contained medium, right, like hour and a half to 2 hours, ideal length for a film, you know, exerts an enormous amount of control over the industrial and creative process in order to tell that story, you know, extremely well. And their signature can be put upon everything that happens in those 2 hours. A showrunner is kind of more like a boss, you know, presiding over a writer's room, you know, with a creative idea and imposing a degree of continuity, but within which all of these creative talents have to be sort of left to their own authorial devices. Like, actors have to kind of, for a TV show to work over 3 to 7 seasons or so, I mean, actors have to begin to blend with their characters and really create and inhabit those characters. You know, the writing team has to be, given a degree of autonomy away from the original, vision of the show's creator, in order for the thing to take on a life of its own, right? And it's like, in that first episode, at least, Spike Lee is not giving everyone else the freedom to sort of be who they are. You hear him in the writing of the dialogue, and you really feel him in the framing. The hashtagging is very gimmicky and intrusive. And I found there were moments when it started to breathe and take on that kind of life of its own beyond him. And I thought this could be a wonderful television show, but I didn't see evidence that that was going to be its characteristic feature as it went on.
I mean, he's spoken in a bunch of interviews. I don't think he actually wrote very many of the...
He wrote the first and the last episode.
Yeah.
And he directed all episodes.
Yeah. So I think it's more the direction. I did find... I liked the second episode better than the first. I mean, I think, like, I actually think that if, how much of it have you watched, Aisha?
I finished it.
Yeah. So I'm curious for you, what does the style kind of evolve over time? Or how does it?
No. It doesn't. I will say, I think in the penultimate episode, there's a moment with her therapist. I really like the scenes, even though when you get scenes with therapists, there's always that chance that you're just like diagnosing the show, and it can get very didactic. And that's what Spike Lee does. Like, if you don't like Spike Lee movies, you're not going to like the show. That's just what it is. But there's a moment with her therapist in the penultimate episode that I think the way it was shot, I found really fascinating. And it was a moment. It was a very long scene in which there was a lot of back and forth going on. And the face, her, DeWanda Wise's face is just like so expressive and emotive that like I loved those moments. And there's a giant, it ends on a giant music, like with a musical number to Prince. That's not, I don't think that's a spoiler at all.
No, that's just an enticement.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, again, I think that I can understand why people would find it intrusive. I even found it intrusive at times. And, you know, some of the dialogue can be very clunky. Like the first episode, she says something and she's like, yeah, I used my training at Pratt Institute, blah, blah, blah. And my boyfriend, he's watched it as well. And he was like, no one says Pratt Institute. They just say Pratt. Like, it's like, there's these little things. And there's like a moment where she says Black Lives Matter and it feels very out of place because it's just like her talking to the camera, but talking about herself. Like, it's, the dialogue can be very clunky.
Especially, I think, in the heterosexual love scenes. It's like, it's so clear that the scenes between the women are better written and I think better acted than the ones between men and women. And
yeah,
it makes me glad that this series, unlike the movie, is not all about these three men that she's juggling, that there's also a lot of female friendship, because it's so much more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, the lesbian character Opal, who was in the original.
Yeah.
I mean, she in the original is very predatory, and there's this whole, like, it's a very poor depiction of a queer female character. Like, she's a predator, essentially. That's how she's depicted. And here, I think her relationship with Opal, and in the movie also, she's Tracy Camilla Johnson's character, Nola Darling, she is not, like, she doesn't swing that way, or she's not bi. She doesn't consider herself pansexual, which I think this character does. Here she's actually, you know, goes with Opal for a bit, and they have a relationship to some extent, and that it's like the most layered, I think, relationship that we see on screen, which may or may not be a coincidence. I don't know.
I just, all three of the men were so annoying. I mean, I had some affection for the Anthony Ramos character just because he's playing the very endearing character Mars that Spike Lee plays in the original. And because it's Anthony Ramos, who we all saw in Hamilton and loved. But all three of the men are so irritating. Why would he want and spend 1 minute with any of them?
I don't get it either.
Yeah. I mean, Aisha, I'm curious to hear you put this show in the context of a very happy trend on television of comedies starring Black women and about the lives of Black women created, maybe not this one, but in some cases created by Black women. You know, you've interviewed some of the creators and stars on Represent. I imagine you'll get to some of these guys at some point, or that I assume they're on your wish list.
Yeah.
But sort of how would you situate this show alongside Insecure and some of the other shows like it that have emerged in the past couple of years that, you know, like the original She's Gotta Have It and still rare in the world of any produced media, just, you know, they're not about the Black experience from the perspective of teaching white people to understand the Black experience in the manner of the help. They're just like full of different Black experiences.
Right. I mean, I'm glad the show exists, and it's a different kind of Black woman we're seeing, because if you look at something like Insecure, you know, this last season, Issa's character was trying to have her hoe phase and was failing spectacularly at it. And we see a woman here who she's not pulling it off in the way that she thinks she is, but she's also, I feel like she has to some extent more self-confidence than Issa does. So I appreciate that exists. At the same time, there's a quote, there's a really good Spike Lee profile in the New York Times from earlier over the weekend. And there's a quote from Samuel L. Jackson, who's a frequent collaborator of Spike Lee's, where he says, like, you know, everyone has three lovers now. Like, this is not like, you know, it's not that taboo, which yes and no. I mean, yes, it's way more accepted. But at the same time, I think that what this show is trying to explore is the idea of, in the same way that Insecure was trying to explore it, like this idea of a Black woman being quote unquote promiscuous and trying to live freely in the ways that other women sometimes are afforded more, and without being called a hoe or a freak. And I found it interesting. But again, it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And I think that if you held a gun to my head and said, which show must you watch? Like, you can't watch both. You have to choose. Like, I'd obviously go with Insecure.
Oh, my God. Insecure. I can't wait to watch Insecure. Whereas I couldn't wait to turn this one off. I'm sorry. It's so anti. But I really wanted to like it. And yeah. I really did like that main character. But I just feel like, I mean, why is he returning to this after 30 years? I feel like there's not enough that's different. It hasn't evolved enough for it to deserve to be blown out into a 10-episode series.
And hasn't evolved as much as the world has in those 30 years. I mean, that was the feeling that I was left with over and over again. The show, She's Gotta Have It, it's on Netflix. Check it out. Come tell us what you thought about it. But Aisha, as always, a pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Polybius Conspiracy is a podcast from Radiotopia. It's kind of in the Serial or S-Town documentary style. In this one, a couple of NPR's reporters try to track down the truth behind an urban legend about a 1980s video game called Polybius or Polybius, an unmarked cabinet that showed up in a Portland arcade one day and began queering the inner life of people who played it. And in fact, may have resulted in the alien kidnapping of one of its star players. We will be joined in a moment by Jacob Brogan, who wrote about Polybius. But first, let's listen to a clip.
Even if you're not already familiar with the Polybius urban legend, it's something you may have noticed referenced on episodes of The Simpsons and The Goldbergs, in the pages of Batman Incorporated No. 1, or in a recent Nine Inch Nails music video for their song Less Than. Best-selling author Ernest Cline used Polybius as a plot point in his latest novel, Armada.
The premise is that from 1977 on, Star Wars and Space Invaders and kind of everything that followed was not an accident. That movie was partially funded by the government to kind of help prepare everybody's hearts and minds for an alien invasion. And that video games and the whole video game industry was kind of shaped and repurposed to train the people of Earth to control drones using their video game consoles to fight off this alien invasion. In Armada, I took it a step further. Like, Polybius was just kind of the first of a series of games, and then I create a fictional sequel to Polybius called Phaeton.
But before it became a sort of pop culture Easter egg, it was just a whisper circulating on arcade floors and the internet.
All right. Well, we're joined by Slate's own Jacob Brogan, tech and culture writer. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Polybius, as I understand it, is kind of in one sense a typical urban legend in that it was confected out of things that had their basis in fact. So, in fact, arcades back in the 70s and 80s would be raided by federal agents. They were looking for drugs or fenced goods or teenage prostitutes and their johns. There were video games that did make kids feel sick. There were unmarked games being beta tested by video companies. And this all bundled together and created this kind of fascinating urban legend. And now there's this podcast. So why don't we begin by talking a little bit about the urban legend and its genesis, and then what you discovered about the podcast.
Right. So the story as told in the Polybius Conspiracy, in this podcast, is that there's this guy, Bobby Feldstein, who claims that he played this game, Polybius, when it first appeared in Portland in 1981. And he got so good at it that he kind of lost himself in it. And then one day he starts having what sounded a little like the sort of it's like the aura of a seizure, this moment where reality starts to come unglued, and he makes his way home, and he feels that his house isn't his own. He actually, in the podcast, Feldstein, as they're interviewing, says that it's like the Freudian uncanny, presumably with an eye toward the Freudian, the German word there, unheimlich, unhomely. And then he kind of blacks out, and these strange people come for him, and they enter his house, and he really blacks out, and he wakes up in this cave in the woods, and he gets rescued by this mauled boy, escapes. And this is the story that he's been telling for years, and no one has believed him. And now, supposedly, he leads walking tours of Portland, trying to convince people not only that Polybius, this urban legend about these arcade games, was real, but also that his own experiences that no one has ever believed are real. And the podcast, the Polybius Conspiracy podcast, from the start sets out to investigate his claims. And it approaches them at first kind of dubiously. The producers of the show are skeptical, but evidence, as the episodes continue of the 7-episode limited series, evidence starts to accumulate that maybe, in fact, there's some kind of truth to Bobby's story. And at first, it's quite tantalizing, I think.
And what's interesting about this is that most people who wrote about this in various publications about the Polybius conspiracy didn't pick up on something that you picked up on and pursued. So talk a little bit about that.
So I'd been texting with the producer of your show, as well as my podcast, Working, Benjamin Frisch, about this show. And I was kind of listening to it. And at first, I was kind of buying it. It felt real. There were definitely real people providing expert commentary. And then as someone who'd grown up in Oregon, I started noticing weird things because it takes place mostly in Portland. What I finally did is I just wrote to the producer, the executive producer, Julie Shapiro, of the show and said effectively, hey, I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, is your show real? And what she told me, what no one apparently had asked her before, was that no, in fact, this show was not entirely real, that there were elements of reality, that they had gotten commentary from real people, real experts, but that many of the characters, including Bobby Feldstein, the supposed abductee, were in fact fictional people. They were actors.
I'm so flummoxed by this because I listened to all 7 episodes for reasons I can't completely explain. What was the point of making an elaborate 7-episode audio quote-unquote documentary that's in fact a mockumentary of the style of audio documentary of discovery and inquiry that has become very popular? Did the producer of the show give you any of the why of like what the conceit of this project was? Was it just to make some good listening?
So Julie Shapiro suggested that they thought it would cheapen the effect if they had told us from the start that it was a work of fiction. I'm not sure that it would have. You know, at no point did I think The X-Files was real when I was watching that in the 90s as a young person, but I did enjoy it all the same. Here, Todd Luoto, one of the guys who actually made the show, Luoto told me in an email that he imagined it as a sort of digital campfire and that they were freely building on the stories that were already out there. And they further, after my own article about this came out and they kind of had to own up more publicly to the fact that it was not, in fact, a real documentary that they were producing. They've suggested in this commentary that they wanted it to be a meditation on urban legends themselves and the way they spread, on the way we experience them. And frankly, I'm just not really convinced by that. I mean, I found a lot of the show compelling, especially in the first few episodes before it starts to go off the rails a little bit. But I'm just not sold that this is the right way to meditate on an urban legend if that's what they were really trying to accomplish.
I mean, can I intervene with an intenser version of that sentiment? I listened to only part of this, so I don't know how many cards they lay on the table later, and I would like those of you who've heard it all to tell me. But I also listened to it, Jacob, having already read your kind of expose and also having read some coverage in major outlets where people didn't realize the thing that you discovered and reviewed it as if it were a real investigation of a hoax, when in fact the podcast itself is a hoax. And that fills me with rage. I mean, I think especially in this moment when fake news is essentially ruining the world and putting us all at risk, that even when you listen to that clip, to sort of present everything in that plinky plunky Radiotopia, let's investigate style, when you're actually lying and hiring an actor to pretend to be this Bobby Feldstein abductee. And it's about a teenager being abducted. And there's also a story of another teenager who might have been murdered. I mean, there's these really dark things that are being just made up and let out into the world where obviously they can turn into whatever kind of urban legend they want. And I listened to the few episodes that I listened to in a state of rage.
Okay, so we all recently talked about a mockumentary that we loved and thought was great, right? American Vandal, Who Drew the Dicks.
It never quite says this is a fake documentary, like bling, bling, bling. Like there's not, you know, it's clear throughout. It's signaled clearly throughout what it is by the fact that it would be impossible for a high school documentary to look this good and be appearing on Netflix, and the wit of the titles and the ludicrosity of the underlying mystery and the whole thing. It's clear what it is from the moment you start watching it. But they don't actually like have a producer come on and be like, just so you know, there is no Dylan, and nobody, answer to who drew the dicks is nobody. Nobody drew the dicks except for the people in our prop department trying to make this mockumentary show that's not real. Like, I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, why isn't it okay for people in this new audio space to play with form in this way? What is it that like, I think where I come down is that this thing is a complete and utter rage-inducing failure, but not every audio fiction or mockumentary audio fiction or effort to play with form would be.
So I think part of what makes this so frustrating, if it is frustrating, is that blending of fact and fiction. A lot of the audio that they use here, especially from the experts, sort of local Portland historians and things like this, that they draw in, they recorded before they set out to make this audio version of the Polybius Conspiracy.
So did those people think they were doing like real interviews for journalism?
So some of them did not. There's at least one of the sort of pseudo experts who I emailed with a little and who was in on it. But Frechette and Luoto were a little dodgy with me, a little evasive about whether they had informed other participants.
That's fucking bullshit.
I agree. Sorry. I agree. But I think that's also what divides it from something like American Vandal. On American Vandal, you don't have, any actual scholars of high school come on and say, you know, well, this is how things work in a high school or whatever. Here you have something like that, and it gives it the force of truth, as does the skepticism that they bear. In my article, I suggest that it inoculates us to some extent against our own skepticism about whatever it is that they're doing.
And that remains the case for those of you who heard the whole thing. That remains the case throughout all seven episodes. There's not a moment.
They never tip the veil. The final line, spoiler, but it's spoiled already by being rotten to the core.
See, I'm whipping her up.
I think the final line is like a tape of the guy, and they've chased him into the woods, possibly to the original point, and then he's left his phone, and you hear a recording where he says something to the effect of like, or something. And it's like, no, it didn't, you jerk. But wait, Steve, I feel like we've been talking over.
No. It's all right. I mean, I just was going to wonder out loud whether had Hillary Clinton won the election, whether we would be enraged or just disappointed or bored. Obviously the timing is really bad for a clever POMO hybrid like this, like a post-truthy hybrid. But I'll tell you what my problem was with it is that, first of all, I immediately knew the guy was an actor, the one person who was an actor.
The supposed abductee, Bobby Feldstein.
Yes, even though I hadn't done the reading yet. I had the strangest reaction, which is I absolutely loved the podcast, the nonfiction podcast about an urban legend, about this mysterious phantom arcade game and the genesis of the urban legend. And I was completely bored stiff by the fictional podcast about an alien abduction, which, you know, I mean, truthfully, Stranger Things is doing 1970s, Spielberg nostalgia so much better and so much more completely. And I did not feel as though this was a fresh take on it. I just think it's interesting that on the one hand, you've got like the mockumentary of Spinal Tap, which clearly doesn't need Rob Reiner to look at the camera and say, I, the actor Rob Reiner, now assert that what follows is not real, right? And War of the Worlds, which got people back in the 1930s, I'm guessing, to go out with shotguns looking for the actual aliens landing. Had Hillary Clinton won, maybe there would be this kind of retrospective respect for what Orson Welles was able to do in duping his audience and kind of no harm, no foul. But, I just think that given the force of post-truth in a potentially totalitarian world, maybe that's a road you don't want to go down.
The one other thing, I'm sort of two minds about even spending that much time on this as a text because it feels like it played with our attention. So why should we reward it with further attention? But I also think there's several levels in which you can critique it. One is the conceit? Is it appropriate to kind of try to pull something like this over on an audience ever? Two, there's execution broadly, like whatever they were trying to say or do with fact and fiction, and it feels like somehow the subject of it has to be fact and fiction if you're going to fuck with the audience in this way. You can't just like fuck with the audience and then have it be a show about video games. Like that, it feels like it needs to have something to say about our relationship to truth and fact and fiction that is compelling and comes through. And I don't think it meets that bar. Then there's its execution as a piece of fiction, like just if you were writing a mystery story, if you're comparing it to Stranger Things or any piece of fiction, like do the yarns and threads add up to anything, weave into anything? Anyway, sorry, metaphor foul. But like this as a mystery, this is basically like one red herring after another, it seems like, and they kind of keep getting a new blind alley, and then they chase it, and then they go down another blind alley. Like it doesn't have the tidiness. It shares in its structure the frustrations of actual audio documentary, where like nothing is ever resolved, and you kind of meet a bunch of weirdos, and they all have a bunch of questions, and nobody gets any answers. Which, if you're gonna make a fiction thing, like give us the fucking answers or something, you know, like give us the satisfaction we can't get from a real audio documentary, where you never learn anything, and life is but an unknowable and tantalizing mystery. Like, just, I don't know, make it the aliens, whatever, sure.
Well, but that may speak to, I mean, the issue with its status as a kind of failed work of fiction. May speak to the underlying frustration of the project as a whole, which is that it only works in as a narrative as a whole, insofar as it echoes the style of documentary radio production, with its uncertainties, its questions, its inability to answer the crimes that it sets out to solve or whatever. And to the extent that it fails as a work of fiction, it also can't work as radio documentary. I mean, all of these things just sort of collapse onto one another. That's a house of cards where the cards knock each other down. I don't know. That's a failed metaphor too. But so is this show.
No, that's good. That just is the metaphor. That's what they mean by house of cards.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think the most effective part of the fusillade are failed metaphors. I mean, anyway, for a failed show. Anyway, we didn't love it, but we totally dug having Jacob on the show. Thanks so much for coming on to talk about the Polybius conspiracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, I'm going to start a new category of endorsements that are probably going to be more coming from me than anyone else. But this was suggested by a listener who was interacting with me on Twitter. And I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but maybe he wouldn't want it to be announced anyway. But he was thanking me for having endorsed long ago, I think it was shortly after Trump's election, the Leçon de Ténèbres, that very gloomy and sad and beautiful piece of music by Charpentier. And he said that we should institute something new in the winter, that instead of the summer strut, we do the winter wallow, which is music that you just want to listen to when things are hard and cold and you're trying to get through the day. And since most of the music that I listen to falls into the winter wallow category, I hereby institute the winter wallow endorsement. And my winter wallow for this week is Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, which is this beautiful, beautiful 18th century setting of a very, very old Catholic hymn about Mary and the suffering of the Virgin Mary. It's a gorgeous piece of music. I really wish that I had a specific performance of it to recommend, because I actually have one at home that I love, but I can't find it online. So I have to just recommend the music. And of course, it matters who's playing it and who's singing it. So if in the future I can find the correct citation for my favorite recording, I will. But really, any recording of this music, I'm sure, would be absolutely gorgeous for a long winter wallow. Again, it's the Stabat Mater by Giovanni Pergolesi. What's Stabat doing there, just linguistically?
I think Stabat, are you a Latin scholar, Steve? I think it means...
Oh my God, absolutely not.
The mother stands, or let her stand. Well, the translation of the first line, Stabat Mater Dolorosa, Iuxta crucem lacrimosa, dum pendebat filius. The grieving mother stood weeping beside the cross where her son was hanging. So I guess it's the past tense, stood.
The mother stood. Yeah, sto stare, that stand. Right. Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. Julia, what do you have?
I would like to recommend that our listeners go get the immediately to iTunes or their podcatcher of choice and subscribe to Slow Burn, which is a new podcast we have released from Leon Neyfakh, which explores the question of what Watergate felt like while it was happening. We are, of course, living in a moment when our president is under investigation, but we don't know how that's going to go. We don't know exactly how to make sense of each development. There's an extraordinary cast of characters already assembled in year one of the Trump presidency, and that led Leon to think about Watergate and what that felt like in the moment, how people processed each little bit of the story before it went down. I think, especially if you didn't live through it, and even if you did, it's been reduced a little bit to the All the President's Men story. And Deep Throat and the resignation and I'm Not a Crook, and you've got, you know, you've sort of got the set of sticking points in your mind for processing the story. But there was so much more, so much complexity, so much to interpret. And Leon and his producer have done an amazing job digging through the archive. There's so much fascinating tape from this era. You can hear all the voices, and it's a really, really great listen that will both teach you about history and make you think about how we understand the world today. So please go subscribe. Slow Burn. It's great.
I mean, Leon is amazing. I can only imagine. And the subject is incredible. So I cannot wait to sample it. All right. So there's a I spend like inordinate amount of time in my automobile, which means I'm accompanied by NPR quite a lot. And there's a show that comes on every now and then called American Roots, which I can be forgiven for having thought for a long time was R-O-O-T-S, because it's about American root music, essentially country and western, jazz, blues, rhythm and blues, zydeco, klezmer, on and on and on and on. But actually, it's American Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. It's a little homophonic pun, I'm sure. Anyway, I caught an episode of it that is so fucking incredible that I have to tell you all about it, and I have to ask Jody Rosen to listen to it and tell me, am I crazy or is this just the greatest thing I've ever heard? It's called Jews and Blues, and it's essentially, and I'm more or less reading from their website right now because I don't want to get it wrong, but it's exploring the connection between the wail of the cantor and the slide of the blues note, where jazz and western meet the klezmorium. They interview legendary R&B producer Jerry Wexler, who worked with Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and later Bob Dylan. And essentially, it explores the relationship between a tradition of Jewish musicianship and record production and their connection to the business end of the recording industry and blues music as it developed in the United States. It's a 2-hour version of the program, and it is fucking amazing. I mean, the music they play, from klezmer to Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet, Randy Newman, Artie Shaw. I mean, the show in general on a week-to-week basis is great about tracing out the DNA of American music, and this particular strand of it was totally gripping and totally fascinating. I could have listened to it for hours, and Wexler is an incredible human being, in addition to being an amazing record producer. And then one other very quickly is that, again, to bring up Jody Rosen, he put me on to the solo careers of both of the lead guys from Drive-By Truckers, both of whom I really admire, Patterson Hood and Jason Isbell. I wouldn't pick one over the other, but I will say the Jason Isbell song Elephant, I don't know if either one of you knows this song. It is a very painful song about a very painful subject, and I, with no irony, give people a trigger warning. It is about a friend dying of cancer, but it is one of the most exquisite and beautiful songs I've ever heard. I mean, I just cannot stop playing this song, both on my recorder and trying to learn how to play it on my guitar. So Jason Isbell, turns out, is just a titanically gifted American songwriter and country artist, in addition to being one of the co-heads of Drive-By Truckers. Formerly, my producer in my ear is telling me Jason Isbell is no longer in the Drive-By Truckers. He is formerly of the Drive-By Truckers. So please check it out and let me know what you think. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
All right. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. You can check out an entire roster of quite interesting and diverse shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
She said, Andy, you're better than your past. Winked at me and drained her glass. cross-legged on a bar stool like nobody sits anymore. She said, "And you're taking me home," but I knew she planned to sleep alone. I'd carry her to bed, sweep up the hair.